Recording. All right. So this is Abel Gomez and Ariel Mejia with the Center for the Study of Religion and the City Coronavirus Relief and Restoration Work. And we are doing interview one with Collectivity. So I'm wondering if you could just start by telling us a little bit about your organization.
Sure. We launched Collectivty in January of 2019. The history of it goes back to sort of 2015 after the murder of Freddie Gray. We formed one of the co-founders of Baltimore United for Change, so a coalition of grassroots community-based faith leaders that came together in response to the murder of Freddie Gray. And during that time, I created the Skills Bank, and the Skills Bank was sort of an on-ramp for those who weren't necessarily on the ground, but who wanted to see how they could plug in. So we had over 260 individuals and organizations join the Skills Bank. From, you know, I'm a mental health professional, I'm a lawyer, I'm a graphic designer, photographer, how can I plug in? So we sort of used that Skills Bank internally as a coalition, and the goal of Collectivity when we launched in 2019 was how could we have a more face-forward platform that went beyond just the coalition, but cast a net to all Black-led organizations serving in Greater Baltimore, and again, make this Skills Bank accessible to everyone. So right now, there's over 130 Black-led organizations on the platform that you can search based on area, focus, and neighborhood. We do a monthly microgrant of $1,000, no strings attached grant, where you submit a 2 to 3 minute video and a community at large votes. So it's sort of a participatory grant-making process where the decision-making is in the hands of the community. The first year, we had over 20,000 people vote. So the community has been involved in this process. And we sort of pivoted to doing coronavirus, the Black Futures Micro Grant, to create the Baltimore Black-led Solidarity Fund. So I could tell you more, but you let me know if I'm talking too much or how.
Oh, no, this is great. I mean, the more details you can provide, okay, cool. The better.
Okay, so yeah, so 2019, we go through that first year, Micro Grant. Every year, every month to a Black-led organization. Fast forward March of COVID. COVID hits in March, and we sort of reimagine the Black Futures Micro Grant to create the Baltimore Black-led Solidarity Fund with the goal of providing $500 micro grants to Black-led organizations in Baltimore. So we always said we didn't have to wait for new data. We were clear that we had 400 years of data and that our communities were going to be impacted. And so we just jumped out there right away. We passed our goal. We reached 100 micro grants for our Black-led organizations, ranging from 500 to about 2,000. Then we just made one for 5,000 in partnership with the Center for Religion in Morgan State. And then we had our day of giving on last Friday, where we raised $56,000 in 24 hours. So we've invested over $120,000 into Black-led organizations since March. Again, these are no strings attached, unrestricted grants to Black-led organizations in Baltimore. So that's a little bit about us. And then we have a whole sort of model that we're going through, but that's kind of where we are right now.
So you said $120,000 was raised?
Yes. Well, we've probably raised over 120 now. Over 120 has been already invested back in the Black-led organization. So, you know, through grants. Yeah, so we'll put out probably another... before the end of the year, we might get another $150,000 out the door. Yeah, just got a few new partnerships and waiting on a big announcement from the NFL. So we're waiting. That has it, you know, they're doing my background check and all that sort of stuff right now.
You spoke to this a little bit, but can you talk a little bit more about how the coronavirus has affected your organization and the members?
Yeah, I think the members in particular, we did a survey in the beginning. Most folks had to cancel programming and events. Most of them rely on programming events to generate revenue. So that was, you know, so that was one of the reasons we knew like we had to do something. Also, we started looking at, for the most part, I'm looking at social impact, community-based organizations. But I began to sort of redefine Black businesses as community anchors, right? Saying, you know, that we have restaurants and we have businesses that offer more than goods and services. They also are like anchors. They're meeting places, they're community gathering. And so we also sort of reimagine business, for-profit businesses, and sort of put them under that umbrella as well. But like from a financial side for us, it's been the opposite effect, right? So I'll have raised probably close to $400,000 since March. Would not have happened if it wasn't for COVID or George Floyd. Like, so we're clear of this sort of reactionary grant making, this sort of rapid response grant making. That doesn't really invest in the infrastructure of Black-led organizations to really sustain us. So, you know, we're clear that, you know, this was a moment. I think we were situated to be able to sort of catch this and redistribute funds back to our community, but we're still really working on how do we build infrastructure for Black-led organizations that sustains them, and where we are a priority beyond these sort of COVID moments or, you know, the murder of Black folk.
Right. So what I'm hearing is then, how does this become something that is like long-term structural rather than just things that people are investing in because of this particular cultural political moment?
Correct. So we see these moments from whether it was, you know, I was in Ferguson as well. So whether it's Mike Brown or Freddie Gray, like we have these moments. Normally what happens though is that money comes into the city always, right? But it normally doesn't flow upstream to what like Dr. Lawrence Brown and Morgan would call the Black butterfly in Baltimore. So he talks about the white L where majority white folks live, and then the butterfly East and West Baltimore. And you know, there's a history of those communities being disinvested and underdeveloped. So even after the murder of Freddie Gray, money comes to the city, but it doesn't necessarily flow upstream. And I just heard recent data from, I think, Baltimore Promise, where majority of the grants, they sort of had a sort of rapid response granting opportunity for organizations. And I believe most of those grants still did not go to majority Black communities. Again, it's people using like capacity and say we don't have enough capacity to, right? Which I think, you know, I debunked that myth, right? We are a volunteer organization. We put out $120,000 in a few months. You know, we have a lot of activity going, and you know, so I think on paper people would say I didn't have capacity, but you know, we're rethinking philanthropy and resource mobilization in a way that's community centered.
Well, I just like the quote, redefine Black business as a community anchor. I was like, I like that quote. So I say that, like, I don't know, made me think. Like,
yeah. Yeah, I think sometimes we leave them out. And particularly, it was a story, it became a big story in NBC. On NBC, Terra Cafe, a local restaurant, denied access to the PPP loan, issue with Bank of America in the beginning where they were only sort of giving loans to clients as opposed to new businesses. And so, yeah, he has someone like Terra who's been around for 15 years at least in the community. We have a lot of community-based organizations host their events there. So, you know, he's an anchor. And if, you know, we lose Terra, we lose an anchor and sort of a community gathering place. And there's a lot of, you know, businesses like that. They're more than, you know, they're part of the community, even though they're businesses, they're very much part of the community.
I'm really intrigued by the way that you are describing these businesses as community anchors. One of the interviews that we did earlier with another organization, a land trust in in Oakland similarly talked about anchors. They use the term hubs, and how these different organizations kind of create hubs that distribute these resources to, you know, in this case, predominantly low-income Black and Brown communities in Oakland. Mm-hmm. And so what you're talking about is, or what I'm hearing, is that it's not ever just about these individual business owners, but it's actually about the ways that these businesses are actually connecting to a broader sense of community in the area.
Correct. And like for me, like early on going into Collectively, it was like, you know, we have this sort of nonprofit industrial complex that a lot of movement leaders depend on. And for me, it was like, how do we mobilize resources not totally dependent on the foundation community? Like we know that out of the $60 billion in philanthropic dollars, Black-led organizations receive about 2% of that. We see that same sort of data and locally in Baltimore around how much money Black-led organizations are getting. And so we're clear, like we have to partner with like Black-led organizations. Like I now told one of my advisors, I was like, I would rather sort of partner with Black businesses to be totally dependent on the philanthropic community, right? So some people like call like, which I push back on, like, these ideas of capitalism. Like my dad was a small business owner. He's not like a big C capitalist, right? He's like a Black man trying to find a way to get free, right? In this moment. And then in that time it was, you know, dry cleaners, nightclubs, right? So sometimes people say like Black capitalism won't save us, which I agree. But I think sometimes we throw the small business person under that big C capitalism when really they're just trying to find a way to be free and have some autonomy in the system, you know, which is good. I think it's different than that sort of big C capitalism where, you know, it's extractive.
Right. Oh man, there's so much here that I'm going to have to be thinking about for quite a while, because this is the first time that I've been thinking about some of these things. I'm wondering if you could talk more about the new programs and initiatives that y'all have organized in response to coronavirus.
Yeah, mainly the newest one has been this Baltimore Black-led Solidarity Fund. Again, reimagining our Black Futures Michael Grant as a way to provide small grants to Black-led organizations. So we've done over 100 now. And it's been great, like, you to hear the stories. Oh, again, too, I also say that we say solidarity, not charity. And we wanted to make sure we were framing it in a way in which, so if you go to our website, you'll see like all the 100 grantees, but it's a way that we are sort of honoring them and uplifting them, as opposed to some of the sort of foundation responses of like, prove how you're suffering at this moment and how much money have you lost, and, you know, which is hard for like proud Black folks. Like, so sometimes we just like, we're not even going to apply for these grants. And so this way, like, so I always say, I look at the racial wealth data, right? If you just look at the data, you know, no matter how good we may look, the data says it's going to take us 228 years to catch up the white folks. So the racial wealth gap is enormous. And so, yeah, there was no need for someone to say like, oh, how to prove that this moment was impacting them. I think some of the racial wealth data in Baltimore is about like Black families cannot last longer than 3 months if lost a job or had a major emergency or health challenge, right? So it's like kind of knowing that data, it was like, well, that's why I said we didn't need new data. It's clear like where we are economically as a community and that a loss of income would affect folks. And I think we probably haven't seen the worst of it yet.
Okay, so for anybody wanting to apply for the grant, can it be like any organization outside of Baltimore that can apply?
Not right now. So right now it's all Baltimore City and Baltimore County. Intentionally, like I wanted to start like place-based and hyper-local, because I think like to do the work we're trying to do around movement building in particular, that it's important like to understand the local context. So my motto is something I call MLK the Baker. So it's looking at sort of decentralized leadership models, right? Moving from these sort of hierarchical leadership models to more decentralized, what Ella Baker would call participatory democracy, right? And so for me, I say we center, you know, to organize decentralized organizations, you must have, like, ideology is the glue. So even when you submit a two to three minute video for us, you must integrate a principle. So we use Nguza Saba, or the seven principles of Kwanzaa. So you have to say, unity is my principle, or faith is my principle, as a way of getting people sort of used to integrating shared values. As one of my mentors would say, like, unity, not uniformity. So what are some of the things that we can unite on? What are those shared values? And so I thought that has to happen sort of in a local context. Me, ultimately, like, this is about building power, but we started with, like, casting a bid net. Everybody's invited, and then we'll decide how we begin to sort of center those values and principles as we go along. Like, I'm clear, like, relationships, obviously ideology is a glue. I'm believing even more now relationships are the glue. Like, that it starts there. I'm part of a cohort now. It's like an 18-week cohort on relationship building for movements. And I'm clear, like, yeah, it's relationship. Like, you can get to ideology or get past ideological differences if I trust you, if we're in relationship. So that's the work we're trying to do now.
And how have these different organizations responded to these new initiatives?
It's been great. Like, so all the feedback we get is, like, super positive. Again, it's no strings attached. They're not even applying. So for the Baltimore Black-led Solidarity Fund, we have a community-based advisory board. So we're just picking for. So they're not even applying. And when we announce it, that's when they find out about it. So everybody's, like, super excited. First folks say, thanks for seeing me. Like, so that's what I hear all the time. Like, thanks for seeing me, before they even know, like, there's money attached to it. Cause there's a lot of folks who've been doing amazing work in the community. So we get, folks who will privately tell us, I just got laid off, or I wasn't gonna be able to do the summer program. Now I'm able to sort of go forward virtually with the program. So, yeah, we've heard a lot of positive feedback. One grant we just did to a movie theater. Again, an anchor, right? He is like, which in movement spaces wouldn't necessarily seem like that, right? But really an anchor. Opened up about a year or so ago, couldn't get traditional loans, sort of floated it themselves through personal loans. And beyond doing the movies, they host community gatherings and showings and all bands and all sorts of things. And so obviously, like, during COVID, they haven't been able to do anything. So we were able to grant them, we did $2,000 for this particular movie theater to sort of kind of help them during this time. And it's the exposure, right? So we have over 10,000 people in our email list, because when you do the monthly micro grant, you vote, community votes through their email. So we've had a pretty good email list. And so we're able to expose folks to other folks. So even if they get our grant, they might get other grant making opportunities, or other folks who just want to individual donors who want to support them.
So you said a lot of, like, some folks don't know about the money, like, that they might receive. So I'm trying to think how I want to word it. So you guys, like, how do you know who you want to pick to give that money to?
Yeah, it comes from being on the ground and being in community. And so, you know, we know that there are hundreds of organizations in Baltimore doing work. I have an advisory board that's in the community. I've also had grantees suggest, like, hey, you should think about so-and-so. They're doing good work. So I've granted like that as well. Like, grantees have nominated folk, and I was like, okay, yeah, they're doing great work. Let's support them. And so, yeah, I mean, normally, again, with the monthly micro grant, the community votes. Mm-hmm. We don't have the capacity, like, to, like, do grant applications, review grant applications, like, yeah. So to move out, like, $120,000 pretty fast, it was based on, like, folks that we know, like, been doing this work, like. Yeah, I could do another 100, like, off the top of my head, of folks that are, you know, been in the work doing community, doing work, and they're, everybody's not a nonprofit as well. So we do community-based organizations, nonprofits, LLCs, you know, whatever for-profit arrangement you may have. which often, you know, is not on the radar of the foundation community. Because if you're just a community-based organization, and you have no legal structure, but you're doing great work and you've been doing great work, right? We catch them. And if you're, you know, a for-profit LLC, which many of our organizations are, like, I'm surprised, but like a ton of them are, that are doing like social impact, community-based work, right? They've sort of given up on foundations. And so they've always sort of generated a revenue generated model. So yeah, so a lot of LLCs, again, who would not be on the radar of foundations.
So one of the things that I'm hearing is that the organization has really understood that the foundation model is not always the most helpful for Black businesses, and that the even within that system, often what happens is various Black and other marginalized communities have to prove kind of their suffering or their trauma in order to get the funds. And yeah. So what y'all are doing is instead selecting people partly in regards to the relationships that you've built with them and the work that you've seen with them in community.
Correct. Yeah, so normally the foundation model is sort of needs-based model or deficit-based model. And we use a more asset-based framework of saying that, you know, the talent, the skills, everything we need, the genius is within community already, that we just need to resource them. So often they're not resourced. And I always tell funders too, and you have to give them the ability to fail, right? You can, the idea that you give a Black-led organization is $25,000 and they're supposed to end crime in Baltimore, it's not going to happen. Like, you got to give them the same ability you give white men to fail. Like, so we know in the venture capital space, black women organizations get about $30,000 and white men get about $1 million to fail, like failing ventures are getting $1 million. And so, and it's not necessarily seen as failure in the same way it would be seen in our community that if I got $1 million grant, they would expect me to change Baltimore. As opposed to like build my capacity the way like white organizations are doing to actually have staff and have, you know, development folk and fundraising and all those sorts of things that they need to sort of keep an organization going.
And so what y'all are doing is really looking beyond kind of the models that have, that exist or kind of dominate the way that money is distributed to various kinds of organizations.
Looking beyond and looking to our past, right? So looking to Free African Society, the AME Church, the Black Church in general, but like these ideas of benevolent societies and cooperatives and the pooling of economic resources is, you know, part of our history, right? Our schools come out of these traditions, our businesses come out of these traditions. So really like going back and looking at ways in which we've always sort of mobilized resources and distribute them in a way that's equitable and just. I mean, we see that, but I think foundations are sort of tasked to fund about 5% of their budget, right? So what was meant legally to be the floor is really their ceiling, right? So at minimum, you're supposed to sort of sew back 5% into grantees, but it's become the ceiling. So they are only doing 5%, and that other 95% goes back to Wall Street or whatever is invested. And so what you see with us, I mean, I don't have the total number, but I could off the top say at least 75% of what has come in goes back to community. All right. So like we're totally flipping what the philanthropic community is doing as mobilizing resources to community. Majority of what's coming in, we're pushing right back out to community.
Okay, I have a question. It's kind of off topic, but like, do you guys accept like volunteers or like interns?
Yeah, like that's something that I want to do now that we're having like the ability to do it. But yeah, it'll be something that I will do, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we have this, I have one advisor, she's actually at Baylor University. And if I get an intern, if that intern is interested in a master's in social work, they can get it for free. like a 1 year program at Baylor University. Yeah. So we'll be looking at that of like if somebody wants to come work with Collectively and they can get their master's for free.
That's awesome. Awesome.
I'm really intrigued by one of the things that you mentioned a moment ago. And if I understood correctly, it was that some of the underlying philosophy and kind of model of the organization is really looking back towards Black knowledge systems, the Black church, which is another really interesting similarity with some of the organizations that we've talked to who are looking back at kind of their ancestral knowledge traditions as the basis of how they're moving forward. And so I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that, these different influences, and I'm particularly interested if you would be willing to talk about the ways that the ideas from the Black church have influenced the work that y'all are doing.
Yeah. Actually, I used to be a director of an organization called the Collective Banking Group. So working with over 200 churches in faith-based economic development in Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. So a lot of Collectively comes out of some of the work we did. We did over $300 million in loans to Black churches and Black businesses. So that model comes out of what I didn't want to do with Collectively was center it in the Black church. So my board was 100% pastors. And I wanted to not center it in this moment in the Black church, but the ideas come from that. Also, I wrote a piece called What's in Your Hand, an asset-based approach to doing ministry. It was for a religious publication. And pulling on like, you know, those sort of biblical traditions and seeing like this sort of asset-based piece. And so one of the pieces in there is around when Jesus feeds 5,000 people. And what one of my friends said, like, you know, it wasn't really like a miracle in the sense of like the little boy handing his fish and loaf of bread. It was that it was his willingness to share. And with his willingness to share sparked other people. Like, surely he wasn't the only one that thought to bring something to this meeting, right? So it was his willingness to share that sparked collective giving. And then when they all gave a little bit of what they had an abundance. So it's that model of saying like, yeah, if we just give a little bit, we can sort of mobilize our resources and we have more than enough. And then of course, like the Black church is this one organization that pulls this economic resources every Sunday morning. I don't know if they're always pulling them in the best interest of the church, right? So some of the data is like leadership wants to put money in buildings in the church. The congregants wants to put more money in services and in like social service sort of work. And so we're pulling from those models though of tradition, culture, ritual, right? Like all those things that create community are sort of technologies that exist in the church. Like even this thing I'm going through around relationship building, right? Testimony service is something like Black folks would do at church when they would get up and say like, this is how my week as God, like that technology is like what we're using in this program is like something that we've always had as a community. We've gotten away from it a lot, I think more recently, but yeah, so just pulling on all of those sort of familiar traditions to mobilize resources. And relationships. I mean, that's what makes the Black church work for me too. Like there are folks in the church who are critical of the theology, but they have relationship. Like my mom, like she's 84. She's missing this under COVID. She's missing relationship. So they're clear like when pastors like, yeah, not hitting it today, right? Or even folks that we know like in the LGBT community. But it's like, yeah, it's some theology that is bad here. But also there are some relationships here that sometimes keep us, you know, there. So for me, it really is like, how do we center relationships, but how do we, for collectively, how do we move away from like bad theology and start anew?
So Ariel, do you have a question or do you want me to come back to you?
I'm trying to word it in my head, but you can come back to me.
Okay. So can you talk a bit about so far in regards to the coronavirus response, the things that have worked really well and things that maybe have not worked as planned?
I feel very good about, like, from what we set out to do. Again, our goal was, 5,500 micro grants. We surpassed that. We've done over 100 now. So I'm excited. The Day of Giving, last year was our first year doing it. We raised $5,000 last year. This year we raised close to $60,000. So I feel good about that. I think that, I'm excited about, like, where we are, what our response has been. We've also, I mean, from the anchor standpoint, we also funded Black restaurants to feed community. So we were saying, like, this is idea of food charity, right? So you get food banks and other organizations that come in, and that can be hurtful to Black businesses. And so it was like, why not fund, like, Black businesses and let them feed the community? So they would charge me what they would charge to feed 200 people, and then we would grant them. And so we did that quite a few times to just say, okay, let's feed community in a way that doesn't harm. Like, so like internationally, sometimes you hear about around like dumping, like where like Tom's Shoes or somebody can come in and put, you know, 1,000 shoes in a village, but like there might be a local vendor who now, like, you know, you just screwed up his whole market, or you're just dumping t-shirts and you're dumping all this sort of stuff from the West, and you're messing with local ecosystems. And so we wanted to look at, again, solidarity as well with our businesses to say, how do we sort of help them stay alive as opposed to just getting charity? Like, so it's a ton of food that's coming to the community, but sometimes folks aren't thinking about how that's undercutting businesses that are already sort of struggling, or he may not even be getting assistance from, like, the government.
So you guys raise money, like, do you guys do like fundraisers or something to raise that money, or?
I raised about $45,000 on a crowdfunding site. About another $15,000 came in just through the same campaign, but just came in through checks. Then I had a local foundation give me $25,000 as well. So they saw, like, what I was doing. They were clear, like, okay, yeah, Jamie, we're doing some things, but we're not going to reach the organizations you're reaching. So they provided us with $25,000 as well. And then our Day of Giving, that's another, like, that's a crowdfunding platform that we use to, like, raise money on that day. With, like, matches from local foundations and business folk. So we'll have prizes throughout the day, like, whoever raises the most money this hour gets $500. Whoever has the most donors this hour gets $500. Like, we did that all day long.
And from what I'm hearing, it sounds like these efforts for fundraising, both largely from kind of crowdfunding. Are there things that you would do differently if you had to do it all over again?
No. No, like, I know. I mean, it's just worked well. Yeah, so it's worked very well. Was hesitant to do it at first. It's like, you know, trying to get to that first $1,000, and you're like, you got five donors, and you want, and then, you know, it began to take off. So that was good. So it's just my hesitancy, I guess, in the beginning. I was just like, do I want to do this right now? And, you know, will it be something that even, you know, picks up? And it did. Like, we started to get a lot of love, a lot of attention around it, and but no, like, the way it rolled out was, you know, us just pivoting what we were already doing kind of well, and I'm happy with the way it went out.
So part of the reason why I ask is thinking about folks that are organizing around Black businesses or other Black organizations in different areas, and sort of what things would be helpful for them to know. Should they be interested in doing a similar kind of initiative of what y'all were doing?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say one thing is, like, having a community advisory board, like having folks rooted in community. So it doesn't seem so top down. Like, again, our whole piece is around this participatory model. We're like blessed to have a board of folks who are really trusted in the community, who run organizations in the community. And so those are the ones sort of helping us decide who gets the money. So I was just like, you know, center it in the community. Another thing we're working on though is our skills bank. So we'll launch our skills bank in the fall, and that will be around like mobilizing the skills of folks. So I think that what happened with some of the PPP loans was, you know, folks didn't have, you know, accountants, lawyers, other folks. So if you have like, you know, I run a restaurant all day long, it's hard for them to stop and go through an application and try to figure this all out. And so for us, what we're trying to do, for at least if there's second round two of COVID or whatever, we are organizing like our skilled professional folk who can assist. So that's sort of the next piece. It's sort of like a LinkedIn sort of platform that we're developing and be ready to go hopefully in the fall.
So you mentioned the Day of Giving. Like, when does that usually happen? Like, once a year or?
Once a year. So it happens every, we just launched in 2019, so this was the second one. But August is Black Philanthropy Month. And so we use Black Philanthropy Month in a way to, like, you know, like even saying, like, in 2019, saying Black-led, folks were like, why Black-led? Like, George Floyd hit, and, like, everybody, like, Black-led. Everybody was like, right? So it was like, it's a lot easier now. But, like, picking Black Philanthropy Month was partly strategic because folks were like, well, why just Black organizations? Why whatever? Like, then again, George Floyd hit, and everybody's like, yeah. Okay, yeah, let's support it. Like, and the data's there, again, 2% out of this $60 billion, right, 5%. To like people of color out of that $60 billion the foundation. So the need is there. And things like Giving Tuesday, like folks have asked us, like some of our organizations about like doing stuff around Giving Tuesday. It's just that we can get lost in that moment. And so I wanted to like carve out space in particular for Black-led organizations. And I felt like Black Philanthropy Month, also Black August, right? So a lot going on, a lot of history in August. So I just felt like August was a great time.
So because of coronavirus, was there something like that had to change, like due to the pandemic? Like did you have to change anything like for the Day of Giving?
Yeah, a lot. So it was going to be like 3 days, and we were going to do immersion tours. So I did for it's organization that I'm on advisory board called the Transatlantic Roundtable on Religion and Race. So they hold these sort of national, international conferences around religion and race. And so I did an immersion tour for them in Baltimore about 3 or 4 years ago with an international delegation. And we're going to do the same thing for the Day of Giving, like let funders, community people, like actually take site visits and spend time with folks who are doing work. We'll also do workshops around just resource mobilization, sort of disrupting traditional philanthropy, just models of like Black giving, from giving circles to other ways in which we have like historically mobilized. So we sort of nicked all of that sort of stuff. And we did virtual DJs and stuff like that all day long, which was cool. Like the DJs were great. So that was really good.
I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about what sorts of additional outside or internal sort of resources would help with new initiatives.
Yeah, so Skills Bank we're working on, so we're happy to get funding for that to roll that out. Grant making software, like so if we were to start taking like applications, like I have like a background in like marketing and whatever, so I use a lot of other tools that aren't really nonprofit tools to like mobilize. So it'd be cool to like have maybe some grant making software where we're sort of, you know, I have a company coming on in the fall that does like program evaluation, all that stuff. So they'll start looking at those 100 grantees and we'll start like getting data on that. So those sorts of things of software that I might, that might help us sort of better do intake for if we put out applications. Right now we're not, but we have some more funding coming in, and so I'll probably do an application process for that. And so yeah, so having some sort of software will help with that. We'll also launch Amplify, which is our multimedia project, which is telling the stories of Black-led organizations. So it's around narrative change and that whole piece. So we're working on redoing the website and start the storytelling. We've done some of that already, but we'll do more.
Wait, so when is Amplify going to be launched?
I'm hoping by November. But actually, I've technically launched it already, right? So it's on the website because I just had to do it. Like, I had to start telling the stories of folks and I needed some way to put it. But It actually will be, like, built out as a real multimedia. So right now, it's kind of like a blog. If you went to the site, you'll see it, like, in kind of blog format. But it will be built out as a real, like, multimedia platform and getting some serious filmmakers here in Baltimore to, like, help us tell the story of folks.
What would you say has been or are the biggest struggles for the organization as a result of social distancing?
Well, yeah, we were going to launch Collective Soup. So you might be familiar with Soup in Detroit. But Soup is, Detroit Soup is a model that I was part of a community financing conference in Detroit a couple of years ago. And they were interested in my micro grants. I was doing micro grants online. And they do what they call Detroit Soup. I think it started in Chicago though, but Detroit sort of perfected it. And it's sort of this crowdsourcing and crowdfunding dinner series. So we're gonna launch that in March. And we weren't able to, so we're now gonna do it virtually in the fall. But it's sort of like you, for $10, you get a soup, salad, and a vote. All that money is sort of collected, and then the winner receives whatever was collected at the door. But you also do crowdsourcing. So if someone had a community project, and someone in the audience could say, hey, I can help you with marketing, or I can help you with your community cleanup, or whatever. So what we're finding, too, is that a lot of folks always say, like, they need funding. But sometimes they just need to be connected to resources. So we had one grantee who wanted to do a community cleanup. She wasn't a grantee. She applied. She didn't win. But it was like, can I connect you with like folks on the platform? So it was like Tendia Family and Communities United and Pan African Liberation, like a ton of people who already do community cleanups. So you wouldn't have to get trash bags. You don't need to go get rakes and brooms and all the stuff she probably thought she needed. It's already there in the community. So that's part of the work too, that network weaving work of sort of connecting dots.
And so these were all things that could not happen in person because of social distancing.
Yeah, so yeah, the collective soup would actually been in community where of course you would get your soup and your salad and all that sort of stuff. And so we were looking really to like build community duties and yeah, so we'll pivot and do it online. And of course, like the Day of Giving, that would have been in community as well. Still the online like crowdfunding piece, but we would have had moments of being together in community.
So how would the you know, giving out the crowdsourcing and the giving out soup, how would that look online?
Yeah, I think that everything minus soup. So, and because we have some funding, we'll probably do like donate what you want or whatever for folks that want to come and participate. And then we'll just put up either a $500 micro grant or a $1,000 micro grant to the winner. We're also thinking about, you know, collaborative ways of doing it. Like, what if you told a group of four people you have $5,000? How would you decide to use this money? So we're trying to find, like, again, the most democratic ways. And, like, even with the Michael Grant, sometimes it feels like a competition online, and we're trying to get away from some of the competition-based sort of ways of applying for grants. The upside to it online is that, so normally you submit your video, and it's about a 10-day voting process. So for 10 days, even if folks don't vote for you, they're looking at your video. And so what everybody has said, even if they don't win, they're getting a ton of visibility. Volunteers are reaching out. Individual donors are reaching out. And so, like, everybody appreciates the visibility, even though sometimes I'm like, it feels like a popularity contest. And I don't want to do that. But, like, the upside is people are getting seen, and they're happy about that.
So how many people vote, like, are voters?
I mean, since I don't even have numbers for this year, but in 2019, over 20,000 people voted. Yeah, so it's been pretty active. And again, like, we have that, we keep every month, you know, we sort of build up the email list through folks voting. And so that sort of helps, like, you know, and then people who win become like ambassadors as well. Or if you're just going for the grant, you become an ambassador, because for those 10 days you're saying, come vote for me. So that sort of helps get the word out.
And what sorts of ways have folks in the organization been able to maintain a sense of community in the wake of social distancing?
Yeah, I think, like, yeah, everybody's zooming it up a lot. So we're doing a lot of Zoom. I know some folks are now, like, trying to do social distancing parties and that sort of stuff. Like, they're meeting at parks and doing that sort of stuff. But mainly it's been a lot of Zoom. More than we want. Yeah, I feel like we're working harder. Like, I'm still in Zoom. It's 9 o'clock and I'm still, like, actually Zoom.
And it seems like, you know, part of the, like, virtual connection is maybe with these stories that are also being shared through, was it Amplify?
Amplify, yeah, is the multimedia project. And so, yeah, and so we've had folks from, like last week, a lot of our advisory board members, like, they created videos around asking folks to participate in the collective give and why they believe in collectively and that whole thing. And then some of it is us going out and actually interviewing, like, the movie theater and letting them tell their story. Like, we're working on an integrated capital fund. So the idea that the issues that they had as far as lending in the beginning is sort of important to some of our next work around us being a lending institution as well. Character-based lending is what we're doing. So not looking at credit scores and those sorts of things.
All right, I have a question. So what made you come up with the name Collectively?
Yeah, I mean, probably my work, like, Collective Banking Group was one, so it was that. Like, I tried to get them to change it to the Collective when I was there. And then when I was looking for, like, a name, well, you really couldn't get Collectively, like, spelled correctly. Like, so somebody has that. So then I just started messing around with letters. And I was like, okay, this works. So that's it. It really was like, I needed something where I could own that domain. And so for me, it was like flipping letters and doing that whole thing that I was like, okay, I could own this. Yeah, so that's it. I can't buy the URL Collectively, the regular Collectively. But I like it better this way. Like, people like, yeah, it's becoming a thing in Baltimore anyway.
Awesome. Are there ways that the organization has observed cultural or religious celebrations during this time?
Yeah, I think definitely online, some of the, like, we help support just recently was the Black Mamas People's Assembly. And that was one of sort of a social distancing type of event where we were at the park, and these were women who came together to kind of put together their priorities in community. And so we sort of helped support that. Not so much religious services. Again, most of those are like Zoom, and so we support that. I have another platform called the Black Theology Project, which is different than Collectively, but the Black Theology Project does a lot of that sort of resources for churches, and sort of it's a knowledge base for churches, particularly those who want to be engaged in social justice. So, yeah, we call it Theology for Black Lives.
So you mentioned the Black Mamas project?
People's Assembly.
People's Assembly. And so that is one of the organizations that has been on Zoom that y'all are connected to, and that there are other organizations that have been doing similar programming through Zoom as a result of?
Yeah. The Black Mamas People's Assembly was not through Zoom. So that was actually an on-the-ground event. In community, but we sort of like caught a grant so that they could do the work that day, so get speakers and all the things they needed for that day. But then there's a ton of our like member organizations. Most of them have all sort of pivoted to virtual summer programs, and a lot of the some of the organizations were working with the schools. So they work with children in the schools, and sort of like all that stopped. And so they sort of reimagined their program throughout the summer. Like Africa, Diaspora Alliance, they normally take the young people to Cuba. And so they did a whole virtual sort of piece where they sort of, you know, do the summer experience and travel to Cuba virtually.
Well, you said African Alliance?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a youth program. It's amazing. In Baltimore, and there's another one called Africa, African Youth Alchemy, and they take young people to Ghana. And they also shoot our it's a film program, and they have shot most of our videos from our grantees. So the young people come and when we give a Michael Grant, they go interview the grantee.
So when do they take it to Ghana? Like around the summertime, or?
Yeah, during the summer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they would spend most of, I think, the spring kind of learning how to shoot film and video and editing and all that sort of stuff. And then they document their trip to Ghana. Yeah. And then, you know, I came into play, and so they started documenting the grantees and stuff.
So you mentioned that there's been primarily member organizations or connected organizations that have been doing kind of virtual online programming. For the organization that you're a part of, are there any kinds of new rituals or practices that y'all have created in response to coronavirus?
There will be. I think a lot of what we're doing now in this cohort around relationships that will embed into the work. So we're looking at, this is an 18-week class that we just finished the first 6 weeks around bonding. And so we'll begin to incorporate those sorts of things into how we come together, how we build trust, how we build relationships. Like, so for me, like I have a cycle around relationship and then actionable, like what will we do together, and then a support network. So I told everybody, like I would spend the first 18 months with collectively building relationship. And so that's what we've done, like been intentional about, you know, they had some funders that I could have jumped into some sort of campaign early on. But I think like campaigns come across as transactional when you haven't taken the time to build relationships. And so it's like, Yeah, like you go into your grandma, you go into faith communities, other places, and you're saying defund the police. And they're like, well, what does that mean? It's easier when you have built relationships. And they say, okay, yeah, I get it. Like, let's move some of these resources to community. Like, they get that. But, like, sometimes we lead with our campaigns, and we're not in relationship with community, and then it comes across transactional. So we wanted to be intentional about spending at least the first 18 months of collectively just, you know, building relationships. And even the micro grants and this Black-led solidarity fund is base building work. It's trust building work. It's like, so we're really being intentional about, like, yeah, we're building our base so that we can do more intentional work.
And the 8 week or the 18 week class on relationships, are those, is that consisting of like members of collectively? Is it grantees?
That is a national cohort. And I have one of my advisory board members. I have two friends of mine who are sort of national like facilitators who I'm gonna bring in to help us with collectively. So it's five of us as a cohort with about five other groups who are from Boston, from California, all over the place. And we're all going through it together, but then we break out in our Zoom breakout rooms and do our like smaller cohort stuff.
And this is something that is organized by collectively?
No, this is Relational Uprising. They've been doing this work for quite some time. I've been to a couple of their trainings. And this was like the more longer, intense, like 18 weeks piece that's like, because myself and the organizations I'm working with that I want to bring into Baltimore, we thought this was a great time. Like we could go through this together and then kind of remix it for our local community.
It seems like the organization is like really based on building relationships with like community partners or members. So
yeah, I always say like Baltimore is a city of generals. Like everybody's a leader, everybody's a CEO, everybody's a, you know, a pastor, like it's just a bunch of bosses. And like you're never, so I was clear, like you're never going to create another organization where like all of us are joining. Like, people are going to keep, like, just like we see churches on every corner, people are going to keep creating programs. And so for me, it was a network approach, that we need to develop a network approach around shared values, shared principles, and we can move. Like, we can be intentional and actionable when we move to action. It may be 10 organizations. It may not be the whole 130, like, but we wanted to have a network approach to building, because I'm clear, again, like, yeah, we all ain't joining the same organization. Folks are going to keep creating new organizations. And that, but we also, through the directory, we're trying to like mitigate some of that. The ability to go online now, and you can see over 130 organizations based on area focus and neighborhood, helps like new organizations do their due diligence in the beginning. It's like, oh, like I didn't know there were 20 people doing mentoring already on my block. Maybe I don't need to do this, or maybe I should be partnering, or maybe I found a different niche. And so I'm hoping too, like it helps folks like do their due diligence before they just jump out there, which you couldn't do really for like, say like we often work in silos, say fragmentation leads to duplication and duplication leads to wasted resources, our time, talent, and treasure. And so that's what you see a lot. You saw a lot of just duplication. So what we hear a lot of times is like folks like, thanks so much, like I had no idea these organizations existed. And for me, like building out the platform, I realized my own silo. Like you think you're kind of connected too. And then you start seeing like, oh, it's folks that have been doing work in East Baltimore for 15 years that I had no, and doing great work and I didn't know existed. So I started seeing my own silo as well.
So I want to be respectful of time, and we agreed to do 1 hour. So I was in the stop here for today. And I forgot to mention at the top of the interview that it is August 17th, 2020.